ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Happy New Year. I hope you rang in 2026 in style. Wherever you are, whether you're recovering or feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, I'm glad to be spending a little bit of the first day of the year with you. Thanks for joining me. Well, it is summer on ABC Radio National, so I'm bringing you some of your favourite stories from the year gone by. And today we're discussing mental health, how to get well and stay well, but also what to do if you think you might be struggling. Coming up, an ADHD diagnosis is a postcode lottery, but changes coming to New South Wales will make it easier for those who need help to get it. Also, the magic and struggles of parenting neurodiverse kids. Around 1 in 7 Australians are on antidepressants. That means over 3.5 million of us took a pill this morning to help us get through the day. Half of that number are long-term users, meaning they've been on the drugs for at least 2 years. Some folks will never come off them, despite a list of long-term side effects like weight gain, sexual dysfunction, and trouble sleeping. We can't deny the benefits of these medications. Many patients credit them with saving their lives. But doctors and prescribing guidelines say they aren't meant to be a long-term fix. A recent article in the Medical Journal of Australia says we're over-prescribing antidepressants and under-treating the root causes of mental illness. You're about to hear from the study's author, who's urging us to take a closer look at prescribing rates. But I'd like to start the conversation with someone who struggled to get off antidepressants after being on and off them for 30 years. Kate Ryan is a Gold Coast-based mum of two. Kate, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks for having me. I think this is a really important conversation to have, so thank you.
Do you mind talking me through your journey? What sparked you being prescribed antidepressants in the first place?
I was really young. I was 12 when I first started taking Zoloft, and it was because there was quite a strong family history of mental health illness in my family. Not long before that, my brother had been treated in a hospital. He wasn't doing too well. And as soon as I started showing symptoms of anxiety, they sent me straight up to a psychiatrist. And before I knew it, I was on 50 milligrams of Zoloft.
And so when did you first try to get off them?
I feel like, from memory, it was so long ago, but I feel like I was on that for a good 5 or 6 years. And then I went off them I think I was about 16 or 17 when I decided I wanted to try and get off them. And I did that on my own, and it wasn't easy.
Talk to me about what it's like when you start coming off them, because I've heard that for long-term users, sometimes the withdrawal symptoms feel like relapsing, which would be really scary.
Yeah, for me, it didn't feel like relapsing. It was a really physical response. So I can tell, like, if I forget to take one of my pills, I can feel it in the afternoon. It feels like my brain is zapping. It's almost like there's a CD in my head that's skipping. I start to get quite dizzy, and I can start slurring my words as well. So that's an indicator that I haven't taken it for that day. So that's how powerful it is. I feel like for me, when I was trying to get off them on my own, that it was so traumatic and so physically hard to get off them that I decided that I'd go back on them. It was just too hard. It was in the too hard basket. So,
what kind of conversations were you having with your prescribing doctors around being on them, wanting to come off them, wanting to stay on them?
The first time I did it on my own, I didn't even tell anyone. I was just like, nah, I don't want to have these anymore. It feels like it's a stigma. I don't need it. I've outgrown any of my issues. So I just tried to do it on my own. I realised quite quickly that that's not something that you can do. I'm very fortunate in the fact that my dad's a doctor. And when I did get off them successfully the second time I tried, he gave me a tapering technique that worked.
You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I've just been speaking to Kate Ryan about her experience of long-term on and off antidepressants, because we're discussing an academic paper which is querying how quickly Aussies are being prescribed antidepressants and when they present to the doctor. Claire from Brisbane says, Kate, are you me? Obviously striking a chord there. Another text from a psychologist of nearly 40 years. I can assure you that our mental health profession does almost nothing to treat the root cause of nearly all mental health problems, which is trauma. In fact, conventional treatments such as psych drugs often make things worse, not better. Well, I do want to bring an expert into this conversation. Professor Catherine Wallace is with the University of Queensland Medical School and was the lead author on the paper I have been referring to. Catherine, hearing Kate's story, is that a familiar pattern that you're hearing?
Oh, hi, Tegan. Yes, it is unfortunately very familiar. The problem that we have is rising long-term use of antidepressants. So people staying on them longer than clinical guidelines recommend for most people, which tends to suggest that people are starting and then not stopping the antidepressants. And there is increasing evidence that antidepressant withdrawal symptoms are common and that they can be severe and long-lasting. And so that's what our research is looking at, developing resources to support people who do want to come off their antidepressant.
You mentioned prescribing guidelines. Can you give me a quick picture of what they are? What are the best practice guidelines?
So the therapeutic guidelines in Australia recommend only starting antidepressants when people have got a severe depression and you try other interventions first, lifestyle recommendations, talking therapies, that kind of thing first. And then medication comes later. And then the recommendations are that the duration of therapy should be, you know, review the medication after 6 to 12 months and consider deprescribing at that point. And I think that's what we're looking at. That seems to be what's not happening. And we know that 92% of antidepressants are prescribed in general practice in Australia. So it's really an issue for general practice, not so much for psychiatry, which tends to see a different spectrum of illness to that seen in general practice.
That's a really interesting distinction you make. And your background is general practice, so this is really your patch. When you're saying that antidepressants are being overprescribed, how do you make that assessment? How can you actually capture what's happening in Australia?
Yeah, that's a good question, Tegan. There are many ways that we might look at that. I mean, firstly, we know that antidepressant use is high in Australia compared to other countries and that it's rising for no particular reason that we know about. We also know that there's unwarranted variation in antidepressant prescribing, with women being prescribed these medications at 1.5 times the rate of men, and also older people, so people over the age of 65, are twice as likely to be prescribed antidepressants as people under 65. And that tends to suggest not that there's some difference about women or older people in their brain, but social issues that might be contributing to how people are feeling and what support and help they might need in their life.
It's interesting you mentioned that. Someone said menopause symptoms are too often dismissed as stress, anxiety, depression, with antidepressants too quickly prescribed. That's sort of what you're outlining there.
Yes, that does seem to be another area at the moment. There's quite a push to recognise menopausal symptoms and to raise awareness about that and get some help for that. And antidepressants is one of the things that seems to be being used in that space.
What would you like to see change in Australia?
Oh, I suppose the big thing is we want to raise awareness of antidepressant withdrawal symptoms, because often when people were first started on these medications, it wasn't known how difficult they were to stop. So firstly, raising awareness and recognition of these symptoms, and then supporting people to go through that slow hyperbolic taper, which helps to minimise withdrawal symptoms and enable people to stop these drugs when they want to stop them.
What kind of conversations would you like GPs and patients to be having together about antidepressants?
Well, I guess the first thing to think about is when you're considering starting these antidepressants. So informed consent discussions at that point needs to include some discussion about the off-ramp. So when you might think about stopping them, if you do start them, and how you might stop them. And then each time a repeat prescription is prescribed, we would like to see a discussion happening then and a decision about whether to think about trying to stop them or whether somebody wants to continue them.
You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I'm speaking to UQ Professor Catherine Wallace, who's one of the authors of a new paper in the Medical Journal of Australia about whether antidepressants are overprescribed in Australia. I would like to make it clear, we are not telling anyone who's on antidepressants to go off them. That is a conversation for you to have with your doctor. But a broad discussion about the picture in Australia as a whole. Lots of people texting in. One person says, I was on antidepressants for about 10 years and it took months and months to come off. Tapering took about 6 months to do the final steps of the weaning to avoid side effects. Anna says, I've been on them for 40 years. My sleep is terrible. I've tried to get off them, but no luck, and no doctors seem to be able to help. Please inform them. So, Catherine, that's really what you're trying to do with this recent paper. Beyond the prescribing guidelines that we currently have, what else could we change here?
So one of the things that we're looking at in our MRFF and NHMRC funded trial.
So the Medical Research Future Fund and the National Health and Medical Research Council, yes.
Yes, so they funded us at the University of Queensland to run a trial testing a toolkit that we've developed to support GPs and their patients to have this discussion about whether or not to continue or stop, and then to support that slow tapering process if people do want to try stopping their antidepressant.
Kate, I'd love to bring you back into the conversation. You spoke earlier about your difficulties getting off antidepressants. Did you feel like you were being made aware of the alternatives before you were being given medication? Because you were so young.
Yeah, I was young. It was an all-hands-on approach for me, I think, because there had been a crisis with my older brother and my parents were scared. It was psychology, it was a psychiatrist, it was medication. Immediately, all of those, like the whole, the triple threat. But it just seemed that, I mean, that's just what it was. I mean, this was, I'm talking, 31 years ago. I don't know if it's changed at all, but yeah, it wasn't even thought about really. And I wonder also if that's because I do come from a medical family. So therefore, you know, medications are relied upon quite heavily in my family as well. And it did definitely help me. It brought me out of what I was feeling.
So did you feel like when it was given to you, it was being given as a permanent solution?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't even really think too much about it, to be honest. I was just really anxious and I just wanted it to go away, what was happening. So I just did what I was told. But I did feel really embarrassed that I was taking it, particularly back then. There wasn't much conversation around mental health, and being 12, you know, sort of just about to go through puberty and that, you're really conscious about what people are going to think about you. And it felt like a really dirty secret that I had as well. But it's changed, I think. I think people are more open to having conversations about it now.
Eva says, I was on anxiety medication after a terrible time in a job. I was anxious and unsure when starting in a new role, and I had thought about leaving even though it was an opportunity I really wanted. Eva said, I had a great GP who prescribed me anti-anxiety for 1 month with a review, and at that time I was told by my GP it was short term for 6 months. I came off after 6 months. It was a tricky few weeks where my brain was having brain zaps, we just heard Kate mention before, which felt weird. It took a few weeks to come off the medication, and I'm forever grateful for a GP that took the guidelines into consideration. So a good news story there. Moving forward, how do we address this growing need for a framework to better address mental health through a more holistic approach, or at least a way to use medication for what it is, one of just a number of ways to tackle anxiety and depression and not the whole solution? Dr. Asta Thoma from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists is here to answer the question of how we move forward from a mental health episode without necessarily turning to medication as a first port of call. Asta, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Tegan. Thank you for having me here.
You just heard Catherine outlining the work that she's done. From where you sit on the psychiatry side of things, why do you think these medications are being so heavily prescribed?
I would rather use the word commonly prescribed. I think if you look at the numbers, we do have enough data which suggests almost 40% of Australians do struggle with mental health issues. And in, you know, the data around 2020 sort of shows around 17% of our Australians do fill prescriptions for mental health conditions. And out of them, one out of seven are using antidepressants. Now, we also have to remember antidepressants are used for many conditions, including depression, but not just depression. So it is used for anxiety conditions like obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and also for some physical conditions like migraine, chronic pain. So in a way, the antidepressants are most commonly prescribed medications for psychiatric as well as physical conditions. So they do play a role. And yes, you know, there is no doubt that we in Australia have become, you know, the second highest country in the OECD countries to be using prescriptions for psychiatric conditions. In a way, it could, you know, there are complex reasons. I mean, it's not simple, straightforward around why we're using more of these medications. And I would like to sort of think destigmatizing of mental health conditions also is a part of it. I was listening to Kate talking about her experience, and what struck me was, you know, feeling embarrassed about being diagnosed, feeling embarrassed about having those difficulties at such a young age. She also spoke about how it ended up in a crisis-like situation where it needed all-hands approach. And you're absolutely right. The all-hands approach doesn't include just medication. It also includes therapy. It also includes support. And when it starts out, you know, nobody takes antidepressants, nobody takes medications lightly. It is a really big decision one makes. You know, whether you're a clinician, as a clinician, or a consumer, or even a family, when you're supporting your family member taking that medication, you know, it comes to a point when you do end up sort of starting on that medication. Now, where it takes us is really important. I think that's where Catherine's work right now is, around at the starting point, it does help. And sometimes, again, it's not simple, straightforward. We do end up going through a few trials of different antidepressants, different medications to find the right one. And when you find the right one, it can be life-changing. I mean, you know, if anybody who struggled with low mood, high anxiety, depression, any of the psychiatric conditions, it's a really hard space to be in. So when you have a resolution of symptoms, it can be life-changing because the condition was so debilitating. But once you've made a recovery, and that recovery can look different for, you know, everybody, once you make that recovery, you do need to come to a point where you want to have that conversation around, do I need to continue taking this medication? And that's where, you know, Catherine and her team's work around the, you know, what does that endpoint look like? How do you make that decision around, you know, how would you go about it? And that support, again, going back to what Kate mentioned, that, you know, she did, and we do, like, you know, at some point you're like, does this medication really help me? I want to stop it. It also reminds you of the dark phase of your life. It also carries a bit of a stigma. And then you know, do you end up stopping that medication on your own? Or do you want to do that with a doctor, someone who can sort of help you make that decision? Mm. How do you come off that medication is so important.
Yes, so important. And so many stories coming through on the text line. One says, I've experienced depression on and off as a teenager and then had a major episode after experiencing a number of challenging life events. I was in therapy, but I felt like I couldn't get myself out of my low mood space. I finally decided to take SSRIs, which is a class of antidepressants. It was an absolute game changer. My life is now very stable. I've decided to try to come off them, but my symptoms have come back with intensity. It's hard to know if they're withdrawal symptoms or underlying depression. Another person says there are so many reasons that people can't access the wraparound care that would be needed to get off antidepressants. A big one is finance and access to good people. Without antidepressants, I wouldn't be able to function. And one more from Beth, who says, a great great big happy shout out to my regional GP in the Illawarra. She's doing all of the things your expert is recommending. Discussion about when to come off at each new repeat and a great understanding from her about perimenopause and mental health. So Catherine, just to come back to you briefly, what questions should people be asking their doctor if they're being offered these drugs?
I guess they would want to know, you know, why, how the drugs work, what they do to them, how the drugs might help them, what the side effects are, and how long, you know, they would be expected to be taking them, and when it comes to stopping, how they would go about doing that. I mean, I guess those are sort of the very basic sort of questions. And I think you know, the other thing to say about these medications is that they're not uppers. They're not happy pills. There's no street value associated with them. And while they do help people or can help people in the short term, in the long term, many people experience feeling numb on these drugs. So they can't feel the highs of life as well as the lows of life. And, you know, maybe that price is a good one. People can pay it or are happy to pay it. But there are other adverse effects that you mentioned with long-term use as well that people might not know about, you know, like weight gain, increased falls in older age. There's some evidence that cognitive decline is faster when you're on antidepressants, and the sexual dysfunction that can have, you know, widespread repercussions for people's lives and relationships. You know, and just getting to the point about, you know, increasing awareness and acceptance of mental health issues, there has been this great campaign, you know, over the last couple of decades since Kate started her medication. And I think that has been successful in reducing stigma associated with calling for help and things like that. But there has to be some questioning when you find that one in seven people are now taking these medications, and there's no evidence that Australians are any happier or anyone's any better off. So I just think we need to, you know, reevaluate what we're doing in this space and look at the pros and the cons and think about changing.
Thank you so much. Professor Catherine Wallace is from the University of Queensland's Medical School. You also heard from Dr. Asta Tomar with the College of Psychiatrists and Kate Ryan, who's lived with depression. And if this conversation has raised issues for you, help is available. You can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. But next up, the huge changes coming that could change the lives of ADHD patients.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond, the arts are just one way Radio National
explores the world in full.
Getting an ADHD diagnosis in Australia can be a postcode and price tag lottery. Waitlists keep growing. Private assessments can cost thousands, leaving many, especially in rural and lower income communities, stuck in limbo. But big policy changes are coming to New South Wales. Soon, both adults and children will be able to go to a GP for ADHD diagnosis and treatment. It's a step further than some other states like Queensland, where GPs can currently only diagnose children. The New South Wales government says it'll cut long wait times and hefty specialist fees. So how are GPs being prepared for the shift? And what does this mean if you're navigating life with ADHD? Well, MJ O'Neill is a transgender musician, writer, and corporate strategist. She was diagnosed in her 30s with ADHD. Sarah O'Doherty is president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. And Dr. Chris Sue is a Queensland GP and the director of the Australasian ADHD Professionals Association. MJ, I will start with you. In 2020, you were struggling. You decided that you needed to seek help and be tested for ADHD. How long did it take you to get a diagnosis?
I'd say probably between 9 to 12 months, depending on when you started. And it was a long... I'd kind of accepted that I'd had some form of ADHD or something that looked a lot like it for years beforehand, but I didn't think I needed help. But then I crashed really badly in 2020, like a lot of people, and I needed to, it was less a case of I decided I wanted to seek help, and it was a case of if I don't seek help, then I don't know how much longer we'll go on.
Yeah, okay. 2020, that timeline, I feel like I've heard a lot of people with quite a similar timeline to that. We were all sort of alone with our thoughts or with people close to us, whether we liked it or not, and that brought up this sort of thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was a time of, let's call it great independence, and it's a case of in executive functioning, you know, that idea of how to organise your life, it's like, particularly I think, I'd worked from home for a long time before that, but I think a lot of people going into that working from home environment, it's like, you're the boss of you and you're accountable to you, and then all of a sudden you kind of need to be a lot more comfortable sort of holding yourself to account than you might have ever had to be before, and then you're holding yourself to these standards that you might not meet, and so it just builds and builds and builds. You don't have that sort of safety net of talking to people, getting more help with stuff that you can't tackle, you don't know how to talk about it, and so yeah, it was, I think I'm not surprised that it kind of led to, I suppose, a grand awakening of ADHD people.
So it took months for you, you said. How much did it cost, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, it's hard to remember and adjust for inflation, but I think when I wrote about it in 2020, it was about $2,000, $3,000. But I think that would be a conservative estimate.
Dr. Chris Sue, you're a GP who's treating people with ADHD in Queensland. Do you hear stories like MJ's pretty commonly?
It's an expensive, difficult to know where to go or where to start kind of process. And there are a lot of people advertising in the space, which makes it really confusing to know which way to go. And historically, while there's some GPs who are really, really involved in this space, like some of the rank and file of my colleagues really also get confused about which way to kind of send people. And it can just mean that people go around in circles and get frustrated and do things a more expensive way or a longer way.
So, Chris, you're in Queensland, where the law here changed in 2017 to allow GPs to diagnose ADHD in kids, people 17 years and under. How did that limitation or how did that expansion and limitation of the rules affect you and your practice?
I have to say that I'm actually not really 100% sure how or why that all came about. I've asked quite a few people around the country who work in this space, and no one really knows. It just kind of happened, and nobody heard anything about it, and many of the specialist groups and doctors still, when I mention it, are kind of surprised, like they're hearing it for the first time. Oh, that's possible. So in no other state in Australia are GPs allowed to actually do that. It's a very, particular to Queensland thing. And it's great because it means that when you know, you're actually able to dip your toe in the water and actually be involved and actually develop the skill to go and be involved if you have the inclination and skill to do so in the GP space. How it does impact things is, and this would be representative of every other state, is that the paperwork burden at 18 is just incredible. And there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and also you sometimes put the risk of, like, you know, vulnerable adolescents and young adults having to go through, again, a sort of opaque kind of system often to get re-diagnosed at 18 or reassessed. Otherwise, they can't continue their care. And for a lot of ADHD teenagers, where one of the main things is if it's too hard, it's not done, it can mean that it's just too hard and it's not done. So that's a really big question. It impacts me hugely from day to day because we have to do a whole bunch of extra chasing, reassessing. We often have to find new clinicians to refer and resend to then be able to get the patients back to just continue the care that we're actually able to do routinely, which costs a lot of money.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about the new changes recently announced in New South Wales, saying that general practitioners, GPs in New South Wales, will soon be able to diagnose and treat people with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, not straight away, and it will be an accreditation process that they have to go to get there. Kate from Berry in New South Wales has texted saying, I recently discovered that my two repeats of my ADHD medication were more than 6 months old and couldn't be filled without me returning to my psychiatrist for a revised script. He's travelling overseas at the moment. So there's literally no other option other than to get a referral to a new psychiatrist with a 6 month wait or wait for his return. The difference between me medicated and unmedicated is pretty profound. Kate continues, to get through, we are rationing my daughter's medication, splitting tablets in half to see if both of us can wiggle our way through to my psychiatrist's return. And George from New South Wales says, getting my ADHD diagnosis at 65 has changed my life. I wish there had been better community education available earlier. But George makes the point that the GP option has merit in the face of a backlog, but there's a specialist need in the system to help manage the ADHD, either with a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So Sarah O'Doherty, President of the Australian Association of Psychologists, thanks for joining the conversation. What are your concerns that GPs might not have the training required for accurate diagnosis and management?
I'm actually really confident that GPs will eventually have that training. I know that the Australasian ADHD Professionals Association will be providing that training to GPs. The concern that we have here is that in terms of GPs and what their role should be, I absolutely love that response from Kate, the caller in, who is talking about needing scripts, needing them now, not being able to access a specialist, but having that ability to go to that GP and have re-referrals, re-scripts, and have that medication when they need it. That is absolutely the correct role for GPs. The thing is here, though, is we have 15,000 psychologists in New South Wales who are already trained in being able to do that ADHD assessment and diagnosis, but we don't have the ability to refer to the psychiatrist. So for that, we do need the GP referral, and we aren't able to prescribe, which isn't something that we want to be doing anyway. But what we do need is that thorough and holistic assessment and diagnosis of ADHD. So I'm really hoping that, you know, the training course that GPs are going to undergo in the next 6 months, for those who are interested in taking up this training, that training course is going to be worthwhile for them. But here is where that ideal partnership between GPs and psychologists is going to be paramount in ensuring that correct diagnosis.
Yes, Sarah, it's such a tangled web. And I think if you've had to navigate it yourself, you know it intricately. And if you haven't, it can be a bit confusing. Children are typically diagnosed by a pediatrician, adults by a psychiatrist, you're a psychologist. How do you see these different specialties working together in an ideal world?
I think the issue here, Tegan, is there is that lack of community education in who is able to diagnose. So yes, a paediatrician can absolutely diagnose. Yes, a psychiatrist can absolutely diagnose, but they are not the only ones able to diagnose. And the role of the paediatrician in the diagnosis, the role of the psychiatrist in the diagnosis is being able to then prescribe and treat ADHD with medication. And that is not the only way of treating ADHD. We know that absolutely medication plays a vital role in the treatment of ADHD. But often children are also diagnosed through assessments that are run through school psychologists or external psychologists when they are referred, when they are little and in primary school. And then for that further additional medication support, they can then go and see that pediatrician for that. So the role of that comprehensive assessment really needs to be through a holistic process. That process is really long. It can go for multiple sessions, multiple hours, multiple assessment tasks that the person needs to go through and complete, that the parents need to go through and complete. And then after all of that, we're then able to have that comprehensive assessment and diagnosis. Now, I'm hoping that there are going to be times set aside for GPs to complete those assessments and have those assessments be as thorough as this. However, what happens to the other patients who are also seeing GPs, and what happens to the GPs who are seeing patients for multiple hours to get that sort of a diagnosis? So there's lots of unanswered questions here.
As you're speaking, Sarah, I can see MJ smiling and nodding. It's like you really know this from the inside, MJ. Looking back on your diagnosis journey and contrasting it with what Sarah's talking about, what an ideal world could look like, what would have made your journey easier?
It's a long list. Starting it earlier is probably a big one up there. But I think, like, to me, what is really strong about what Sarah is coming across with there is the holistic approach. Like, I saw the same psychologist, I still see the same psychologist since, like, 2009, and she has been instrumental in regards to whether I knew I had ADHD or not, just helping me cope with life and figuring out how to actually take care of myself and manage things to a colossal degree. But she essentially was able to have no dialogue throughout the diagnosis process. Like, there was no way for her to kind of submit a letter or, like, to talk to either of the sort of, well, any of the three psychiatrists that I saw as part of it. And I think she could have provided, like, vital context. One of the problems I ran into when I was kind of doing the diagnosis was they were like, well, you're so accomplished. I am a person of quite extraordinary capacity. And so they kind of went, you couldn't possibly have it and still be sort of operating in this way. And it's like, if I could have had my psychologist or even just my GP actually be able to talk more openly with the psychiatrist in question, they could tell them, like, the struggles around that, as opposed to, I think, coming just from me, there's that problem of psychiatrists having to weigh, like, is this what you're saying because you think it'll get you where you want? Is this necessarily this sort of thing? But if I could have had that sort of more connected healthcare sort of journey, it would have been, I think, a lot more... It would have made it a lot easier on all of the professionals involved, I think. And I think if that had existed before all of this, I probably would have been put on ADHD medication a lot sooner because my psychologist would have a pathway to recommend.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking about announced changes in New South Wales that GPs will be able to prescribe and treat ADHD in the coming months. B says, thank you for this focus on ADHD. I spent 5 years on a public waiting list and then another 2 trying to find a psychiatrist through my GP who could work with me. She said, you're better off going private. The private diagnosis required personal letters from friends and family, school records, and a referral from GP and psychotherapist. It was a 7-year journey, and I'm still waiting for a medication script. So, Chris, coming back to you from that GP's point of view, Sarah spoke before about the other patients that a GP is working with and perhaps what it means for the GP's workload to be part of this. What trade-offs are we potentially making when we are bringing GPs into this process, or do you think it's a net good?
So basically, it's more that the pool of genuine ADHD specialists in this country is, like, tiny. Like, there's 300 or so child psychiatrists in the whole country, which if you look at 10%, 7.5% to 10% of children have it, those numbers don't compute, and genuine developmental paediatricians are not much higher. There are some GPs who are very specialised in this area, and I think what you'll end up having is actually a very tiered system of GPs. Like, you've got going to have some baseline guys who will just continue prescriptions, and that will already be huge. You'll have some people who will be skill up enough that they won't diagnose, but they will prescribe and titrate the medication, because that's a huge skill in itself. And GPs are actually really, like, actually quite good at doing that already and monitoring for harm. And then you're going to have a few people like me who just go the whole, you know, kit and caboodle. And basically, I'm general GP and only my initial training. I don't do anything other than ADHD, and it's hugely changed my practice. And the trade-offs are that, yes, a lot of my usual patients have had to find, like my older patients have had to find a GP who is actually available, who can actually do it, because I'm just so inundated with ADHD stuff. But there's so few ADHD specialists in this area, or people helping people to negotiate this system, that I've accepted that even though I love general practice, so I chose the specialty, this is my lot in life and how I can make the biggest difference now.
Sarah, looking at a national perspective, we have such a patchy system across the country, state by state, because that's how the way our health system's set up. What would you like to see a bit more consistency across Australia?
That's a really great question. And I just want to echo what Dr. Chris was saying just before. You know, this is going to be a drop in the ocean for people who require that holistic assessment and diagnosis for ADHD. And as he's saying, the prescription and medication side of things is the GP specialty. So I really hope that this is going to have a really big uptake for GPs. And if we're looking at it from that national level, as I said, in New South Wales, we've got 15,000 psychologists. Every one of us is trained to perform an ADHD assessment and diagnosis. And the majority of us actually do this in our practice. Now, what we need on a national level is an equitable and accessible funding stream for this to occur. Now, the federal government and Medicare does not fund ADHD or other assessments with psychologists. So if a patient wants to come and see us for that assessment, they're paying often in the range of $1,200 to $2,000 plus per assessment per person. And that is a really comprehensive assessment, and you get the diagnosis and you get the report, but then you don't have that access to the medication. And that's where we need that link to the GPs. So the GPs are going to be able to prescribe that medication. And if we did have Medicare on board, if we did have the federal government support to extend Medicare to psychologists, we would then have already thousands of psychologists able to provide these assessments at a much more accessible and affordable fee for patients across Australia, not just New South Wales. So I would really, really be lobbying, and we're still the Australian Association of Psychologists, are heavily lobbying the government to extend Medicare to ensure that we can have more of this provision of services, because as Dr. Chris was saying, we just don't have enough people to be able to do that assessment and diagnosis and treatment in Australia.
Thank you all very much. Sarah O'Doherty is the president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. You also heard from Dr. Chris Sue, Queensland GP and the director of the Australasian ADHD Professionals Association, and MJ O'Neill, who was diagnosed with ADHD in her 30s. We'll stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Next, we'll be discussing the wonder and struggles of raising neurodivergent kids.
Hey, it's Anthony Burke here. Radio National presents The Homefront. Housing in Australia is under pressure. The crisis is real. But could better design be part of the fix? I'm Anthony Burke, and in The Homefront, we explore how the great Australian dream is shifting and what we could do to build a better future. To hear The Homefront, search Radio National Presents on the ABC Listen app.
As parents, our job is to train up our kids to navigate the world, but so often they end up teaching us about ourselves too. Sarah Hayden is a mum of five, including two neurodivergent daughters. You actually might know one of them. Chloe Hayden stars as Quinny in the Netflix series Heartbreak High. Well, in Sarah's role as a social worker, she's supported many families with their neurodiverse kids and spoken at conferences about parenting, ADHD and autistic kids. Then, at 48, Sarah learned that she had ADHD and was neurodivergent herself, a discovery that she says was cathartic. She's sharing her family's experience in a new book called Parenting Different: How to Raise Your Neurodivergent Kids to Be Their Authentic, Awesome Selves. Sarah, you're a mum of five. Two of your daughters, Gemma and Chloe, are neurodivergent. How did they come to be diagnosed?
So their stories are quite different. Chloe's shared her story herself many times in her book and conferences, so a lot of people do know about it. But basically, she was struggling. It all came to a head. She was struggling enormously at school, well, her whole life, but particularly when she transitioned into high school, which tends to be a really difficult time for a lot of neurodivergent kids in particular. And after trialing several high schools and all of them just things getting worse and worse, we actually eventually had a teacher contact us in year seven and say, hey, have you ever thought about taking Chloe to see an educational psychologist? Which I was absolutely shocked, because in my eyes, Chloe was the most perfect, amazing little person, and the problem lied with the school and everybody else, not with her. So after sort of thinking about it, we thought, well, there's probably nothing to lose. We'll take her to an educational psychologist, for whatever reason that was. And we got into one, and within literally a few minutes of meeting her, she just looked at me and said, look, you know, obviously we've got many, many more tests to do over the coming weeks and months, but I can pretty much tell you exactly what's going on, and that is that your daughter is autistic.
What was it like to hear that? How did you deal with that?
For me, it was a massive shock. I think, you know, we're an educated family. My dad is a doctor. My mum was a nurse. I wasn't yet a social worker at that time, but I was studying nursing. And it, for me, she just, I think at the time, she just did not have any of what I would think was, you know, the look or the symptoms of what I so naively perceived autism to be. You know, for me, really all I knew about autism was, you know, was boys' autism, and you know, growing up sort of seeing movies like Rain Man, and I was like, autism, she's not autistic, she doesn't look autistic. You know, I just had no idea about what a girl, you know, presented with autism. And so I think, yeah, I was shocked. I was devastated, not for the diagnosis, but for thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, what kind of mum am I that my beautiful little girl who we've just doted on, you know, and thought she was just the most perfect child in the world. She had so many quirks, but so many incredible strengths and talents and gifts. And I just kind of, it was almost like this flashback of looking back over her life and how awful it had been in so many ways, with so many school changes and friendship troubles and sensory issues. And it was like this light bulb moment as I was handed some literature, particularly on, you know, autism in girls. And I was kind of reading through the checklist going tick, 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 tick. And I was like, oh my goodness, how did I not know this? So there was this unbelievable mother guilt. There was this absolute devastation that we'd kind of got to this stage and having no idea, and also just absolute shock of going, how do other people not know this, that autism presents so differently in girls? So it was a combination of a lot of big emotions. And then, of course, you know, after that, with me even beginning to say to people, you know, oh, we think Chloe's autistic, it was the same kind of response from everybody of, no, she's not. Like, you know, my nephew's autistic, she's nothing like him. It's, you know, and then you're sort of battling against this other people's perceptions of it as well. The only person at that time who I think was like, yeah, I kind of told you that, was I actually went back to the teacher and said, hey, like, did you send me to the educational psychologist because you thought that Chloe was autistic? And he, you know, very quietly off the record, because teachers aren't supposed to do this, he just sort of said to me, yeah, I had a girl in my class a couple of years ago, and the minute Chloe came into my class and he started seeing all the struggles that she was having, he said she just reminded her so much of this other girl that he'd taught. And so he, you know, and I'm so thankful that he did, because they're not supposed to, but he sort of quietly came to me and said, you know, he didn't say autism, but that's what he was kind of alluding to going and getting a diagnosis of.
So then
he hadn't spotted it. Yeah.
Sorry. I just wanted to clock the fact that we did say two of your daughters, your other child Gemma was diagnosed as an adult, as a young adult, and then you also had your own ADHD diagnosis only very recently.
Yes. Yeah.
So how has your diagnosis and your children's diagnoses changed the way you parent?
I think my own diagnosis has changed the way I parent myself, the way that I perceive myself, the way that I look back over my life, and particularly my childhood and teenage years, which were really, really difficult. And it's given me the ability to sort of, I guess, be more caring and loving towards myself and understanding, which I still continue to try and do to this day, having a better understanding of how my brain works and what I sort of need and the adjustments that I need to make for myself to be able to get through, you know, each and every day the best version that I can. In terms of parenting the kids, like, I think we had just naturally sort of adjusted. It's funny, like when Chloe had her autism diagnosis and we were sort of given, you know, very few, but a few of the kind of tips or strategies or ideas and things that I was reading, it was all stuff that we had actually started to do without knowing she had the diagnosis. You know, I always say parents are the best people for their children and know better than any professional. And I think, you know, we had just naturally started to do all of these things, not realizing that it was because she was autistic, but because it was what Chloe needed. And, you know, we were just sort of following those leads for her, you know, like buying sensory friendly clothing because we knew that tags and certain fabrics, you know, drove her crazy. So, but I think it's, you know, more than anything, I think it's just that having that diagnosis and that understanding and validation, it sort of gives you permission, you know, for yourself, but also for how, you know, how you're raising your kids and what, you know, what they may need to be able to be the best version.
Absolutely. So we're obviously here talking about your family and your own experience, but Australia's first national autism strategy has just been released. It aims to improve everything from mental health outcomes to social inclusion. In your mind, do you think it will help neurodivergent children and their families?
I hope so. I'm hopeful and quietly optimistic, with maybe a dash of skepticism thrown in there. Look, I hope so. I mean, yes, they set out to, you know, their vision is for a more safe and inclusive society for all autistic people and to improve the outcomes. And absolutely, that's what we want for all of our kids, neurodivergent or not. And, you know, I'm hoping that, yes, it will give a greater understanding and that education around, you know, particularly for girls and women. I think that, you know, historically we've been so boy-focused on diagnostic criteria and, you know, sort of the traits. And so I'm hopeful that it will give more understanding across the board, because I think for neurodivergent people there is such a misconception and misunderstanding often. And even just, you know, we've seen that play out in the last few years in the public eye here in Australia, where some, you know, celebrities, Em Ruskiano and people like that, have come out sort of saying that they have got a diagnosis, and just some of the responses that they've been met with just shows the ignorance and misunderstanding of what it can actually present like.
Yes, so much more that we need to learn. Sarah Hayden, thank you so much for sharing your own experience.
Absolute pleasure.
Sarah Hayden is a social worker and author. Well, earlier in the program, you heard about the tricky road to come off antidepressants. And I spoke to Kate Ryan, who was reflecting on living with depression for most of her life. Here's a bit of what she told me.
I was 12 when I first started taking Zoloft, and it was because there was quite a strong family history of mental health illness in my family. Not long before that, my brother had been treated in a hospital. He wasn't doing too well. And as soon as I started showing symptoms of anxiety, they sent me straight up to a psychiatrist. And before I knew it, I was on 50 milligrams of Zoloft. It was so long ago, but I feel like I was on that for a good 5 or 6 years. And then I went off them I think I was about 16 or 17 when I decided I wanted to try and get off them. And I did that on my own, and it wasn't easy. For me, it didn't feel like relapsing. It was a really physical response. So I can tell, like, if I forget to take one of my pills, I can feel it in the afternoon. It feels like my brain is zapping. It's almost like there's a CD in my head that's skipping. I start to get quite dizzy, and I can start slurring my words as well. So that's an indicator that I haven't taken it for that day. So that's how powerful it is. I feel like for me, when I was trying to get off them on my own, that it was so traumatic and so physically hard to get off them that I decided that I'd go back on them. It was just too hard. It was in the too hard basket. So the first time I did it on my own, I didn't even tell anyone. I was just like, nah, I don't want to have these anymore. It feels like it's a stigma. I don't need it. I've outgrown any of my issues. So I just tried to do it on my own. I realized quite quickly that that's not something that you can do. I'm very fortunate in the fact that my dad's a doctor. And when I did get off them successfully the second time I tried, he gave me a tapering technique that worked.
Well, that is it today for Life Matters, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Catch up on any of the stories from today or any time on the ABC Listen app. You'll be hearing Beverly Wang's voice at this time tomorrow, and I'll catch you again on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.